Before I start with the talk, a number of you have asked about the Ecoderma Center, so I'm going to try to stop a little bit early and just give a quick update about the center, because I think rightly so, lots of us are excited about it and interested in what's happening. So I'll try to do that. In some ways, impermanence is easy to understand, and because of that, we can maybe overlook the fact that it's not so easy. It's different. One of the famous quotes that came down to us from the Greeks, from I don't know if it's Heraclitus or Heraclitus. Heraclitus, okay. You've got that from the Greeks, like you know that? Okay, good. you can't step into the same river twice. It's a famous quote. You can't step into the same river twice. And so we can kind of take that on different levels. And the first level is the most obvious, that rivers always flowing, always changing, the currents up and down, the source of the water is different, et cetera, et cetera. So just on a very simple level of geography, rivers always changing, you can't step into the same river twice. That's impermanence. Actually, any study of any natural science, you're going to run into an impermanence factor, whether it's astronomy or geography or geology. Impermanence is going to play a big part of what that science is about. So that's an easy way to look at that quote. But then there's another level, which is the you part. You can't step into the same river twice. We're, as humans, just like a river, we're constantly changing. What we are is actually distinct in each moment. What our thoughts and feelings and body experiences are make up the sense of me in each moment. So that's constantly changing depending upon what conditions are like and what's happening inside of us. So the you part is always constantly changing. So that's a flow. We are much more than a thing, we're much more a process. And I think for anybody who's meditated, that's sort of, we get that, right? If you observe yourself over any length of time, oh, this moment is different, now I'm different. So that's another level of, you can't step into the same river twice. And if you just take those two levels, that quote makes perfect sense. And that's an understanding of impermanence that we can investigate. We can investigate it from an outside perspective. Sitting next to a river with our senses, seeing the river, hearing the river, feeling the river. If we open to that and we let go of the concept of river, then that experience is constantly changing. If you get into the river and start floating down it, it's constantly changing. All of a sudden, the perspective of being on the side of the river, where it seems much more like, oh, that's the way this part is. But then if you start floating downstream or going upstream, which is harder but possible, then all of a sudden, it's like around every bend, it's a totally new river. And it's lovely to do that, seeing, hearing, and feeling river. In the same way that we observe ourselves, meditating or not meditating, we observe the sense of me, the sense of what's happening inside, feeling the image that we have of ourselves, the thoughts that we have in our mind, constantly changing. And that can be part of a practice. That is part of our practice, just observing in and outwardly what's happening, seeing a change. So we could leave it at that. That's cool. End of talk. But there's more. There's actually more. This is where it gets really cool. If we look further, what's a river? Never mind the same river. Never mind the changing of the river. But what, in fact, is a river? Is there actually a river? Is there a thing that we can say, okay, that's the river? Now, if that's the river, then everything else around it is not the river, right? For something to be something, it has to be something, meaning it's separate from everything else. Does that make sense? Is that fair? Okay. So where does the river start? If it's a distinct thing, where does it start? Well, it seems like a simple thing. You pull out a map and you say, okay, that's where it starts. But that's just a blue line on a map. So you get on your backpack and you start hiking and you start going into the headwaters and you try to find the beginning of the river. Does anybody know where this is going? Has anybody ever done this? There is no beginning to a river. There are many beginnings. It actually starts as various, sometimes thousands of tiny little springs and sheet flow and little tiny rivulets that only happen when it rains. And then they gather, and then they gather. And at some point, some geographer said, okay, that's where the river starts. And then another geographer says, no, it starts over here. And then another one says, no, it starts over here. And then there are conferences, and then there are institutional organizations around the headwaters of the Colorado Geography Association trying to figure out, like, well, where does the Colorado River start? Well, nobody knows. Now try to figure out where it ends. It doesn't have an end point any more than it has a starting point. Rivers end where? In the ocean, right? Okay, so get out in your boat and go paddle around at the end of the river and find the spot where it ends. Well, it doesn't. The water starts mixing. It depends on the tide. It depends on the flow of the river. We get deltas. We get all kinds of estuaries. The river just sort of muddles its way until it's the ocean. Now come to the side of the river. Okay, we can't find the beginning or end. Now let's try to find the side of it. The river is sloshing, it's rising in the rain, it's falling in a drought, it's moving all over the place. It's a moving target on anywhere where the bank is too. And the river is water. And where does the water come from? It comes from rain. Without rain, no river. So it's connected. It's connected to everything. In fact, there wouldn't be a river if there wasn't everything on this planet, and there wouldn't be a planet if there wasn't everything in the universe. So we can't really separate the river from anything else. So not only can we never step in the same river twice, but we don't even... River is just a concept. It's just a word that we use, because without the word river, we couldn't talk about it. It would be really hard to make a date to go fishing without the word river. It wouldn't make any sense. We have to be able to communicate. So we use words to communicate and symbolize things. But then, because it's so simple and so easy to use words and concepts to symbolize things, we start to believe that the word, that the concept is the thing itself. So we start to believe that we actually know river. We know what a river is. We know all kinds of things about it because we can say the word, and the word is so powerful. So we lose sight of the fact that river in and of itself is unknowable. It's not definable. It's connected to everything. So not only can we not step in the same river twice, but the truth, there's an experience of something that we call river, but there is no actual river in terms of the concept. There's just an experience. And because of the fact that we use words and we think words, we end up with words getting in the way of the actual experience of things, the actual mystery, the immensity, the unknowability of river or rivering. If you sit next to a river, if you float down a river for days and weeks, then at some point it hits you. This is just absolutely mysteriously awesome. I don't know what this is. Just by opening to the experience of it, the immensity of it. You can't just see a river. You can only see a tiny little piece of it. It's coming out of something, and it's going somewhere. And all we can do is capture a very tiny slice of it in each moment. And by not experiencing it as a concept, but just actually the immensity of what's happening in front of us, or underneath us, or around us, then we realize that you can't even step in a river. You can only get wet. Or you can only get pushed downstream. Or you can only feel the coolness on your face and on your arms. And you can only hear the sound that the water makes. And you can only see the flow. And then we come to the you part. You can't step into the same river twice. If a river is unknowable, if the concept of a river becomes a barrier to the unknowability, to the mystery of it, then the same thing happens with our sense of self. Same thing happens with our sense of self. I'm going to step in the river. But what's the me that's stepping in the river? How knowable is that? If we get beyond the concept of me, the identities of me, the name that we give ourselves that other people call us, what's actually stepping into the river? Who's deciding to step into the river? There's this mysterious consciousness that we have no idea where it came from. We have no idea how we got here, but here we are. And paying attention to it in each moment, if we pay very careful attention to it in each moment, we realize that this consciousness, this beingness that's animating us, we can't see its beginning. We can't see its end. It doesn't have a boundary. We don't know where it came from. Just like the river. Where does your consciousness begin and end? And even more mysteriously, paying attention, paying careful attention to our experience in each moment. We can do it right now. Right now, in this moment, there's a distinct consciousness that's not the consciousness of when you walked in here, or when I started talking, or when I was talking about river. This moment in and of itself is complete and distinct. And now this one is. And now this one is. And now this one is. In our ordinary thinking, in our ordinary perception, we can say, oh, I've been here. I can look at the clock. Okay, well, there's evidence. We've been here for an hour and 24 minutes. So there is some kind of continuity. But that's only evidence. That's only a way of thinking about it. If we really look at our experience, there was no passing of time. There was just a moment, and then a moment, and then a moment, and then a moment. But just like the word river is a shortcut, a powerful shortcut to communicating about the world, but it's not the thing itself. It's not the truth of the experience. Our experience of being here is simplified by how we think about the passage of time. So we can think about the passage of time, oh, I've been here for an hour and a half. And on one level, that's true. On a level of communicating, that's useful. How long were you there last night? Oh, it was about 2 hours. I mean, it's not that useful to say, well, there were a lot of moments. Moments kept arising. And then all of a sudden, I was in the car, and those moments kept arising. And then I was in a different place. And then the moments were arising, and I was at a traffic light, and it was red. And then moments kept arising, and the people behind me were honking because I wasn't going when the light turned green because I was too in the moment. So these concepts, how we simplify our experience, is useful. But it's not the truth of our experience. The truth of our experience is right now, right in this moment. It's like, this is distinct. And this is a mystery. This is amazing. How did we all get here? Right now. And then again. And then again. Yeah, the body's doing its thing. We get that. The body's here. But our consciousness, our awareness, our actual experience, if we look at it and don't simplify it, don't gloss over it, there's something different in each moment that wasn't there before and will never be there again. And this is a practice. This is a key, this is a sort of a doorway or a key to practice, that each moment is in and of itself completely different, completely distinct. It's just about paying attention to it. It's just about being there for it. Thought, our thoughts and our emotions and our body sensations, which can become familiar and repetitive, give us the sense of, oh, this is the same. This moment's just like the last one. I'm still sitting in this chair. I'm still talking to you. And therefore, yeah, nothing's changed. It's just the same. But if I just stop and really pay attention in each moment, there's something that's like, whoa, here I am again. How did I get here? How did this happen? How did I end up in this river? not just being the identity, the me that I think I am, but just the awareness in each moment of how that moment is right now different, distinct, unique, and somewhat mysterious, somewhat magical. All the conditions that came together to make now happen. So I think in terms of stepping into the same river twice, this is what Heraclitus was getting at. I think he had all the other stuff built in, but I think this is what he was really trying to communicate, was this deeper, more mysterious nature of our experience, the magical, the magic of consciousness. That consciousness all of a sudden finds itself in this river. Again, finds itself in this river. Again, in the river. Each time we wake up, each time we become present, each time, here we are in the river again. And something about that is unique, something about that is different. I mentioned that the river couldn't be there without everything in the universe being there. It's really not separate. Without the sun and water and clouds and the whole hydrologic cycle and the whole history of the geology of the earth, all of which came from material that came out of exploding supernova, et cetera, et cetera, that river wouldn't be there. It's not any separate, distinct thing in terms of how planets work or how the universe works. It's completely a piece of all of that. It's only our concepts that separate it. Oh, that's a river. That's the bank. That's the mountains where it starts. That's the ocean where it ends. That's the planet where all this is happening. Those are concepts. The actuality of it is it just is. Without everything, it wouldn't be. And we're the same way. We're the same way. None of us would be here without everything else. You know, we can start with our parents, we can start with whoever built the church, we can start with, you know, all kinds of stuff, but it all eventually goes back to everything else. So in that sense, we wouldn't be here without the river. The river wouldn't be here without us. We certainly wouldn't be here without the river. So in the most ultimate sense, which might seem a little bit more abstract, it probably is a little bit more abstract than what I was talking about just prior, which is the experience. There isn't that much separation or difference between us and the river. What's our bloodstream but the inside river? What's our body but the whole hydrologic cycle? It's mostly water. Personally, I would rather sit next to a river than do almost anything. Sitting next to a river, and if it's the right kind of river, getting into the river. But there are some rivers that it's cool to get into, and there are some rivers you ain't going to get into that river twice. You may get in it once, but you may not have an easy time getting out of it. Which is why we like boats. But sitting next to a river, sitting with a river, seeing it, hearing it, feeling it, the spray, the coolness, the madness, watching the swirls, hearing the swirls, then all of this kind of interesting and enjoyable Dharma talk kind of stuff becomes alive. Then we can make it our own experience. So the encouragement is to step into that river. But we can do that. We can do that at any moment, because that same flow of experience is always happening in each moment. That same, oh, now, and again, is always happening. It's very accessible if you wake up to it, if you let yourself see it, hear it, and feel it in your own experience. Below the level of thinking about things. Because when we experience things through our thinking, through the concepts, through the words, then they're the same. It's just a river. It's just me. It's just you. It's just ta-da, ta-da, ta-da. And then that's all it is. The concept is never going to change. The word doesn't change. But when we can drop below that, then it's unknowable. It's new. It's just what it is. Now let's just sit for a minute. So I did want to talk about the Ecoderma Center, but we have time that if there's any questions or discussion about this quote or what I've said about it, I'm happy to do that too.
You know, that is what perplexes me about this thing. How come we developed in this way that we are continuously holding on? Okay, we have habits, I get that. But somewhere something is built in there, and I can't get my finger on why and how and all those things. You know?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure that, you know, we could say, well, evolution did this because of that, because we don't know what animated evolution. But I can say that if you look at it from a perspective of what drives evolution, which is more. It's survival. And what drives human evolution is a certain level of cooperation and a certain level of social cohesion, then that conceptualization, that simplifying of the world through concepts and then letting concepts sort of direct our experience has inherent survival value.
In order to communicate.
Yes. It's much more useful for us to say, hey, let's get down to the river and get in boats and go to the other side because there's more land there, than it is to say, well, let's sit here and meditate and figure out what the nature of our experience is and see if there's any reality to river or any truth to our concept about it. So, you know, this is really cool that we have the time and space to do this, right? To do Dharma. But from an evolutionary perspective, it's not the most important thing from a survival perspective. Getting the fish out of the river is more important. That you got to do first.
Priorities.
Yeah, priorities. And evolution is not, I mean, you could look at it and say, well, you know, evolution, there's good news and bad news, right? The good news is we have the potential to awaken. The bad news is it's only a potential. So we have the inborn capacity to survive. Evolution was much more concerned about our survival. We have all these tools for survival. Awakening is a potential that takes a whole lot more. For most people, I mean, some people accidentally wake up, and which is kind of cool. But if evolution had done it right, we'd all wake up. Right? Somewhere around our 15th birthday, we'd all wake up. That's what we should be wishing for evolution to do in the future. Right? Yeah. Yeah. We can talk about it in terms of verbs and nouns, you know, because our language forces us to talk about things, doing things like verbs and nouns. But really there's rivering, or there's being or doing. So I think that's a way that our language could, but it'd be really awkward to re-engineer the language. So we're kind of stuck with these, well, that's the river. But you're right, it's rivering. You know.
So I have a question that's related to Tom's question, but it's like a different angle on the same question, which I've been just thinking about how humans are designed imperfectly for this goal that we're seeking to attain, and yet we're very, very attracted to the notion of perfection, and we love the idea of excellence and perfection, and yet we're very, like, I just like inherent contradiction being deeply flawed, and I just is sort of interested in what the teachings on perfection are, because it doesn't even seem helpful to me to have the concept of perfection.
Yeah. I don't think perfection is, I mean, in terms of the human aspect of us, there's no perfection. In terms of the divine aspect of us, we're already perfect.
What do you mean by the divine?
Right, it's like,
okay.
You know, like what you could talk about in terms of Buddha nature or true nature, or the part of us that's whole and connected and non-separate, which isn't our lived experience, but we can give it those words and we can connect to it. And when we connect to that in our own experience, whether it's for a moment or for a lifetime, there is a perfection. And there's also this humanness, which is always going to be imperfect, and that we're always working to improve it. You know, that in terms of their, you know, if you look at saints, Buddhas, people that we know or have heard about that seem to have achieved some kind of high degree of enlightenment or high degree of awakening, they were still on a path to manifest that in their own humanity and get better at it. They weren't perfect at it. They made mistakes. They did things that they learned from. It didn't just all happen perfectly. But at the same time, there was a perfection there. So it's both. That's how I see it. I don't know. But I like seeing it that way. Anything else? Yeah. No, I think that's a great question. Yeah, so the question is there a method that I use when meditating to focus on impermanence as distinct from other practices such as loving kindness? So we don't need to conjure impermanence and we don't need to find it. What we just need to do is tune into our sensory experience very carefully and then it is impermanent. So the technique is to pay particularly close, and this is just classic mindfulness, classic insight practice, that you just pay very close attention to one aspect of your experience. So it could be, you know, one way is to just the actual sensation of the breath in the nostrils. And that's impermanent, right? It's changing constantly in and out and in and out. It's hotter, cooler, et cetera, et cetera. But you can also sit next to a river and just hear it. Just listen to it. The bare experience of the sound is the flow of impermanence. That's all it is. Or if you look at it, if you watch the water, that's the bare experience of that seeing is the flow of impermanence. Rivers are great for impermanence, but there's almost there are almost any sound in nature is going to give you that flavor. The breath is an experience in nature. It's a body experience of nature. So almost any body sensation is going to give you that experience of impermanence. So whether it's the inner nature or the outer nature, it's our own body, our own emotions, our own thoughts even, not the content of our thoughts, but just the ebb and flow of them, paying attention to that is impermanence. Does that make sense? It's everywhere. It's harder with things, like human-made objects tend to manifest less impermanence, but looking at a candle, just watching a flame, without thinking about it, you don't need to think about impermanence. You don't need to find it. It's all that's happening. Just look at the candle. Yeah, was there another hand back here? Stephen. Yeah, I was kind of trying to talk about that. If you pay careful, close attention, and if you can drop into the place that isn't experiencing things through thought or concept, then each moment is in and of itself unique. And whether things are changing in your sensory experience or not, they're still completely different. But sometimes it's easier to get to that place by watching things or listening to things or feeling things that are changing and noticing the change. But at some point, we can have the direct experience that everything is changing all the time, including the subjective sense of what's present, the arising of me. That's arising. That's changing too. And then at that point, yeah, time is a different thing. Time gets really trippy if you read about, like, you know, the physics of time. Time doesn't exist in physics. It exists in geology. It exists in our human experience, but it's not an absolute in the way that reality is structured. Our mind creates it out of necessity. So it's not that every experience has to be an experience of the flow of time. Yeah, last one. Yeah, that's an important question. And there's a lot of dimensions to it. So for our ordinary emotional challenges, not like depression with a capital D, which is it's a different thing, but just for our day-to-day, oh, this makes me angry, this makes me sad, this makes me ashamed, or I feel ashamed, or I feel angry, or I feel sad, or I feel depressed. All of that is impermanent, and it can be helpful to realize it. And it can also be helpful to examine it with awareness and openness, moment to moment, how that's playing out in the body. And seeing that it's actually not a solid object, but it's a waveform. That there are moments of it's stronger and it's here, and there are moments when it's a little bit more diffused, and there are moments when it's gone, and then there's a thought, and then it comes back, and maybe it's stronger. And we can actually observe that sort of flowing quality of afflictive emotions from an experiential place. Not so much the thought and the story, but the actual visceral experience of it in the body. And that can lead to a deeper acceptance and a deeper integration of that kind of emotion. And that's a very valuable practice, and I'm sure a lot of people here have done that at different times. In terms of deeper varieties of depression, that's a whole different thing, because some of that is tractable with meditation practice, and some of it isn't. And so this kind of approach, or this kind of understanding, has some utility with deeper varieties of depression, but it certainly isn't all of it. There's a different aspect to it. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So I did want to just briefly update. How many people here know about the Eco Dharma Center? Okay, good. So a lot of you, not everybody. There's brochures over there if you want to grab one, and there's a website, Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center.org, which is a lot of words, rmerc.org. Or just Google it. There's only one of them. So a year ago, several Dharma teachers in Boulder, myself, Peter Williams, David Loy, Kriti, and a whole lot of donors, hundreds of people, and a whole lot of volunteers, put together 180 acres up above Jamestown of beautiful mountain land at 8,500 feet with incredible views, and bought it to turn it into a retreat center for our sanghas, our local sanghas. And we were open last summer briefly. We had like three or four retreats there. And then we closed. And this spring, we've been working on it. And the buildings were built somewhere between 1890 and 1939. And most of the buildings have not been really updated since then. And the updating that was done was kind of lackadaisical at best. So it's a lot of time, a lot of money. Barry's been helping us a lot. Josh over here is helping us a lot. Josh is the resident manager for this summer. And we have a full summer's full booked retreats from a variety of different teachers, including David and Barry and myself and David Loy and Kriti and the Denver Zen Center and Mark Coleman, if any of you know of him, and various other folks. I hope I didn't forget anybody here. Doing retreats almost all summer, pretty much continuous from the beginning of the summer through October. So this is a really nice resource for us to have in our backyard. It's only 30 minutes from Nobo as a place to practice, both for longer retreats and also day-longs and sangha events and things like that. So we're trying to get open. The first retreat is going to be the Denver Zen Center on June 12th, and we're working very hard to get the place remodeled and open by then. It's no different than any other construction project. It's taking longer than expected. But we're planning on being open for that retreat. And there may be some sort of Sangha community events before then. There may be a day long on June 9th. We'll see if we can pull it off. But there'll be other events like that this summer. And it's all volunteer-based. It's all donation-based. It's all Dana-based. It's the people have been incredible in terms of the generosity. We're trying to raise a total of $940,000, which went towards buying the land and then all the remodeling that we need to do. And we've raised almost $500,000 of that in the past year. So we're a little over halfway to our goal. So if anybody here is sitting on a huge pot of money and you're feeling really generous and moved, come on up. We'll take a visit. I'll show you the place. And smaller donations have also helped quite a bit in making this thing possible, and also people just coming up and working. And it's really fun to come up and work on trails, work on cleaning, work on the lodge if you have skills.
What's the total acreage?
We have 180 acres. And then there's national forest land that sort of makes it big, because we can walk right onto the national forest land. So it's quite large and quite beautiful. So the invitation is to become involved. This is our resource, you know, and right now it's like it's not even clear to me or to any of the people who are working on it what this is. We don't know. We put a seed in the ground and we're watering it and it's just starting to pop up, but we don't know what species it is. We don't know what it's going to look like when it's grown up. We just know that that's our job right now, is to get that thing to grow. But it might be 20 or 30 years before we even know what kind of tree it is. But I know it will bear fruit. So thank you all. So let's just take a moment. Maybe close your eyes. And just feeling our own goodness, our own wish to be happy. And feeling how that wish extends, not just for ourselves, but for everybody here. And then feeling how that wish can extend to everybody that we know, family, friends, acquaintances, wishing them all well. And then opening our hearts further to all beings everywhere. Feeling that wish for all beings. What we wish for ourselves, we wish for all beings. There in the heart as it expands. May our practice together help all beings become free from suffering. Thank you all.